CliffCentral.com.
So the Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's. This morning we're really talking about a very important issue, I think, because we've got a number of months of evidence that we can now start to incorporate into models of whether or not lockdowns worked, what the success of those lockdowns was or wasn't. And the only person I could think of who's able to be objective about this, because they've taken an enormous amount of information and made it understood to those of us who really don't spend our lives crunching numbers. Nick Hudson, tell us a little bit about Panda before we carry on, and then we can begin to do a deep dive into what you guys have discovered.
Sure. Gareth, and very good to be on the show with you guys.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry it's taken us so long, but better late than never.
It's okay. We've been very busy. Panda is a group of volunteers, and we are motivated by one thing, and that is to secure a good future for all of our children. We all see in the reaction to this epidemic an enormous overreaction, and one which threatens science, reason, our way of life. And for that reason, the members are all very, very committed to the cause. We are all people who have day jobs. And notwithstanding that reality, there's been an enormous effort from people from a huge variety of professions. Some of our members are represented on our website. Some of them are unable to be because they're members of institutions where what we have to say is dangerous or would put them in an impossible position. So it's a much larger organization than meets the eye. We have international members. We are supported by scientists from the profession of epidemiology and virology and immunology. We have members from actuarial science, economics, law. It's a very diverse group. Lots of, big, broad range of political leanings. We've got your, what I think people would knock as social justice warrior types, and we've got libertarians, you know. Actually, we don't really have libertarians. Classical liberals, I think, would be the word.
Yeah, Nick, I'm interested in a number of things here. You've said a few things that are going to no doubt raise some eyebrows. So let's dismantle any criticism of what you do from the point of view that you're politically motivated. You said just now you want your kids to grow up in a better world. I'm pretty sure there isn't a person in the world who doesn't want that for their children. Yeah. So that to me, it kind of sounds like a little bit of a hero complex, but let's put that aside. I want to be sure that I'm dealing with credible people here, because I know that there are going to be government people, there are going to be pro-lockdown people, there are going to be social activists and many other groups of people who are going to say, oh, Panda are just a bunch of politically motivated, non-scientific people. So let's dismantle that first of all. Let's establish the credibility. When you talk about scientists and people who are interested in the raw data and interpreting that raw data to make sense of decisions, how do we qualify that? Are we talking about people whose, you've said already, it's not their whole job to do this. Are these a group of people who are just interested in knowing what the analytics are around this? Are they people who have qualifications in that respect? Are they people who speak from a position of expertise? Just so that we can be clear that you guys are not some politically funded, politically motivated, politically coalesced group that has an agenda. Explain that to me in the best possible way you can so we can move beyond that point and actually start looking at the numbers.
Okay, well, let's start with the last point, the funding. So far, Panda has been funded by its members and speaking engagements.
Okay.
There's no external funding.
All right.
Okay. When it comes to the expertise, I should have pointed out that many of the people who are working in Panda are doing the same thing for Panda that they do in their day jobs. So data scientists, statisticians, that kind of thing. I'm an investor. Okay. So I don't do the coordination of a group of experts studying an epidemic during my day job. Okay. But I do coordinate businesses.
Okay.
We also have scientists who are in the fields supporting us. We've got a very exciting announcement coming up about we just buttressed that with some international scientists who have looked and considered our work and have decided they want to support our initiative.
Right.
And I mean, it's no great secret because two of them have been promoting the work on Twitter. I did a summary of an interview of Professor Martin Kulldorff of Harvard University, Professor Jay Bhattacharya.
I saw you talking to Stanford's Professor of Biophysics and Cambridge PhD Michael Levitt the other day too.
Indeed. Okay. Professor Kulldorff and Professor Levitt.
Professor Levitt's a chemistry Nobel laureate, among other things. So these are not people who are pedestrian.
They're definitely not pedestrian. And Martin Kulldorff is one of the best professors of infectious diseases in the world. You don't go and find better people than that.
All right.
And so we'll be launching that in the next few days. We just, there's a little bit of legwork that goes behind that kind of effort. We have had assistance from the epidemiological community in South Africa as well, mm-hmm. but it's been covert. And I can't tell you who it is.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I mean, you reserve the right, like all the journalists in this country who always name, you credit their unnamed sources. Yeah. And we seem to accept we tend to accept that as news without any further explanation required. Canton, you and I both know that many of the news organizations in this country who claim to be credible news reporting organizations are actually just a front for politics, but we'll put
that aside. Sources familiar with the matter.
Yes, exactly. That's pretty scary. So, all right, Panda, we have some idea of who Panda is and what you guys do now.
Gareth, let me add. Sorry to interrupt.
No.
I left off the doctors right mm-hmm. from the beginning. We had support from some great doctors, three doctors who have profound expertise in the area of in one case immunology, in the one case treatment. In the one case, rheumatology, which is very closely related to immunology. So Dr. Brietz, Dr. Witt, and Dr. Carmen. And they've been around, with us for a long time. So it's not, there are some public South African healthcare professionals in the mix. It's a real pity that I can't talk about the epidemiologist.
All right. So that's okay, because I want to look at what you guys have discovered, because a lot of this stuff runs contrary to the narrative that we see in the news all the time, that lockdowns, in fact, the president himself has gone on record a number of times. William Kize was saying it just the other day, the Minister of Health. Oh, the lockdown has helped us save lives. So let's look at that as the starting point here, because any criticism of lockdown inevitably brings the counter reaction from the lockdown fans that it has saved lives. Is that something we can say is absolutely true?
No. We cannot say that. When you look at the data, and we've got tons of data on this epidemic, we can discern no signal in the data for the effectiveness of any non-pharmaceutical intervention, including lockdowns, including mask wearing. There's no signal. So it's simply false. And this is not just our finding. That is cropping up all around the world. There are a couple of very bogus academic papers out there claiming to see an effect. But when you go into the detail of those papers, they are frauds.
Am I correct in assuming that this is global and not just limited to data that you're seeing out here?
It's very important to study this on a global basis. And we have done that from the start. The virus in South Africa is the same as the virus in Belgium. It's gonna have features. And we've been banging the table for a long time saying, please look at what is staring you in the face. Because the epidemics elsewhere in the world, more or less came and went before South Africa even got going. Well, so you could read a whole lot and you could see where this thing was going,
All right. I have arguments constantly with people who say, but look, England is under lockdown. Britain's gone into a second hard lockdown. Their second wave has come and hit there. And if the British government are doing this, then it must be right. This appeal to authority, just because it happens to be a government outside of ours, they're just as stupid, in your opinion.
It's the other kids are doing it argument, right? Yes.
All right.
I spend a lot of time. I've got teenage kids. I spend a lot of time pointing out the fallacy of that logic.
Right? Yeah.
In every country, there are voices now who are standing up, and saying no more. This is so destructive what is happening, and this there are many components to it. It's not just the laws and the crazy rules and regulations which are stifling life in general, you know.
All right. I'm not going to ask specific questions here, because I'm sure you have plenty of really interesting stuff to tell us. So why don't you give us the top line findings, and I'll shut up and Canthan can interject when he has questions, because I believe that what you have to present to us is way more important than what I, as an outside observer, may be able to ask. Go ahead, Nick. Floor is yours.
Okay. So the first thing I would say is this, that the scale of the epidemic is much smaller than was originally feared. Okay. The second big finding, it's not a matter of data, it's a matter of reading a few words on a page, is that this virus is not really that new. It's so closely related to prior coronaviruses, which circulate broadly in the general population, that it is recognizable to the immune systems of a great many people, the majority. And that gives us a level of inbuilt protection against this disease. So the naming of the thing, new coronavirus, novel coronavirus, okay, was really a bit misleading. A better name for it, in fact, would have been asymptomatic SARS. Because most of the people who are infected, meaning that the virus enters their cells, don't even know it. They never have any symptoms.
That's why we have so many people who come up with the test and they found to have had coronavirus, but they didn't even know they did.
Correct.
Particularly young people and healthy people who don't have comorbidities.
Correct. Yeah, they'll either have no symptoms, or they will have such mild symptoms that they just fail to appreciate that they've been infected by the disease. And that is the majority. It could be true that it's the vast majority. Okay. We don't know for sure. And the reason we don't know for sure is that for some people, the infection doesn't even provoke what's called an antibody response, which is something that you can test on what's called a serology test to work out whether the person has been infected in the past. So they won't even show up positive on those tests.
Wow.
Their bodies have worked with the mucosal immune system or the cellular immune system to fight off the infection. It hasn't gone into the kind of systemic response that promotes an antibody reaction that you can use to detect whether they've had the infection in recent months. Okay.
This is fascinating. Now, is there any marker whatsoever you guys have been able to find that actually points to a particular propensity to be infected, given that from the numbers you've been crunching, we're seeing that most people are not even aware that they're ending up getting it? So what are the markers that make one susceptible?
So it's a great question, Canton. I mean, and I would just like to distinguish between the people who get infected and the people who get the disease. Okay, because being infected by the virus and having the disease are two different things. The people who are susceptible to the disease and to severe causes of the disease and to ultimately dying overwhelmingly tend to be old and very ill in some way, the so-called comorbidities, okay? That's the overwhelming majority of these cases. And we were aware of this very early on. You got these amazing statistics coming out of Italy showing that 96.4% of the people who had died had one or more serious comorbidities, and the word serious is important there, okay? Now, the other 3.4% who are left out of there, we don't know that they didn't have comorbidities. They may well have undiagnosed comorbidities. We don't know.
Right.
Okay. And it does seem to be the case that the doctors of certain patients are mystified. You know, a sort of a perfectly healthy 60-year-old who's running marathons and doing 50 push-ups a morning, will succumb, you know, but it's very rare. This is not a substantial portion of the cases that we're talking about. So the comorbidity and age factors are really important. Another factor that's a marker is obesity. It is an independent risk factor from comorbidity prevalence. So we can see that too. But, you know, overwhelmingly, we're talking about old, the very old, the comorbid, and the seriously obese who are at great risk. Okay.
So if we just pause on seriously obese for a minute, we have a huge obesity problem in South Africa. Does this not in some way, if obesity is such a contributing factor, doesn't this in some way justify to a larger degree a country like ours deciding to protect people in whichever way governments in their infinite stupidity decide to make improvements to people's lives and end up doing a very lame form of social engineering, certainly in respect of lockdowns? That's what we've seen happen. But is it not an argument to say, well, you know, in this country, we've got lots of people who are immunocompromised. We've got lots of people who are extraordinarily fat. Shouldn't we protect these people by doing whatever we can? And that our case may have been modeled more severely as a result.
Okay, so here's the very important thing. And I just want to correct one thing, or maybe correct a potential misapprehension. When I say it's a risk factor, this is not like it's sort of a deadly risk for a person who's overweight, slightly overweight or whatever. It just adds to the risk. Okay, so we're not talking about mortal danger all the time. Even for the most at risk, you know, the survival probabilities are reasonably high. So we mustn't overstate the risk. Okay. But to your point, what should we do to protect them? And here's another one of our findings. Okay. An enormous mistake that was made by modelers all over the world when they modeled out these lockdown situations and tried to project how to protect people was that they failed to capture an age differentiation in their models. Okay. When you insert into these models a recognition that there are different groups of people, that there are susceptible people and non-susceptible people. And here I'm talking about susceptibility to severe disease course and death. Okay. They failed to capture that reality in their model. Now, there are.
So you're saying, for example, that because we have a disproportionate number of youth in most of this continent, and Italy, for example, has a disproportionate number of older people, those were things that were not taken into account.
That is part of what was not taken into account, but the bigger part is that when you build models with that heterogeneity, the big word for, you know, differences between people, mm-hmm. recognizing that there are some young and healthy people for whom this does not present risk, recognizing that there are some old and ill people for whom this presents a lot of risk. Mm-hmm. When you put that differentiation into the model, the optimal strategy that emerges is to protect the old people and let the young people get on with their lives. In fact, you know, some of the epidemiologists who build these models talk about corona parties. Why? Why do they talk about a corona party? Because the quicker the disease spreads through the low-risk portion of the population, the faster you build up what's called by this horrible term herd immunity, or its alternative community immunity, mm-hmm. and the epidemic's prevalence wanes. And when that happens, it's safe again for the people who are at risk to go out. The longer you stretch this thing out, the more risk exposure those older people get, because it's not possible to perfectly isolate from the rest of the world.
Which has always been the rationale behind Trump wanting the schools to open up as quickly as possible.
Yeah, not just Trump. Sweden from the get-go had this.
Well, Sweden from the get-go. Yeah, Sweden never actually the lockdown.
And how many newspaper headlines have you seen, Canton, saying that after 5 months of schools being open in Sweden, that not one child has died?
No, you don't read those headlines because,
no, you never
because
did,
if yes. If I quote Nick Hudson in anything that you've said right now and I put that in a Facebook post, I might be flagged for spreading fake news. It's
yes.
amazing how, and in this country, that, you know, there are certain restrictions to the law which make it almost impossible, legal restrictions on our free speech, if you ask me, make it impossible for me to actually quote you, despite the fact that what you're presenting here is pure scientific data. For me to use any of that in a post on social media could get me into serious trouble.
Absolutely. And, you know, the attacks come in a variety of ways. It's not just the social media platforms where this is difficult. I was speaking to a doctor from Canada last week, an immunologist, mm-hmm. a very proficient person. You know, she's top notch, yeah. lovely person as well. And she was saying that she faces professional attacks for yeah. talking about the existence of T cells and cellular immunity. Now, these.
Isn't that, that's long ago established. I mean, T cells and the way that we make ourselves immune to things like the common cold or the flu or whatever it might be that we develop a resistance to, that is well understood. This was stuff that they were doing tests on in the 60s.
Absolutely. I mean, and South Africa, you know, we have a lot of expertise about cellular immunity, T cell yeah. immunity, because of our huge HIV epidemic. You know, CD4 and CD8 cells.
Right.
We can remember those words. The counts of those cells were very right. important
yeah,
in
course.
Understanding the severity of AIDS. So we've got lots of doctors who are the world's leading lights.
While we're on all of this stuff, the big news, obviously, in Europe at the moment is the second wave. And this is also, you talk about news headlines. This has been the biggest stuff in Europe for the last couple of weeks, is the second wave, which is frightening people for a second time. Oh, God, it didn't kill you last time. It's coming to kill you this time. So let's just talk about the second wave, because as I understand it, there are more infections because there are more tests being done. But there are almost no deaths.
Your understanding is correct. And in fact, the irony of all of this is that it's our state president and the head of our MAC, Professor Karim, mm-hmm. who are presenting the fake news here when they talk about a deadly second wave and say that we should lock down if there's an uptick in cases. That is nonsense. It's unscientific nonsense. The second waves in Europe, as you say, have been waves of cases accompanied by much, much lower levels of death, insignificant levels of death compared to the first waves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And let's put it in context. The death rates in the first wave, okay, for younger people were much lower than the flu. And for old people were in line or slightly higher than a severe flu season.
Right.
Okay. In the second wave, there's nothing worth speaking about from an epidemiological perspective. Why is that happening? Okay. The first thing is these tests are being used in insane ways. There's a parameter in these tests called the cycle threshold. Okay. And what those tests are doing is amplifying the viral RNA. And with each amplification, that's called a cycle, okay? And you cycle once and you've got twice as much material. You cycle twice and you've got four times as much material, and then 8 and 16. At 40,
mm-hmm.
you have amplified massively now.
Just explain something to me, but I don't quite get how amplification works. You're talking about when you detect a particular data sample, you artificially increase the value of it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, when they take sample from a patient, mm-hmm. now they must go and find the RNA of this virus, okay? The proteins of the virus.
Put it
here,
in
you're taking me way beyond my personal expertise here.
Basically put this material into a centrifuge, and then you try to extract out the DNA that is the human component of this, and then to find out what the viral component is, you take out some of the RNA and you do an assay analysis of what it's made of.
And with each cycle of that process of amplifying the RNA for detection, you basically go two, okay? And at around about 30 cycles, it becomes very unlikely that a person is infectious or actually carrying viruses.
Yeah.
Yeah. And some authorities in the matter say you should be basically testing at 24 to 26 cycles. We're testing up at 40, which is thousands of times more powerful than it needs to be. And what comes with that is a couple of things. First of all, you detect people who've had the virus in the past and have recovered and who are no longer infectious. Okay. And you also start picking up false positives.
Mm-hmm.
From things like lab contamination, sample contamination, you know, and so from an epidemiological,
we've seen lots of those false positives, because I know of people who've taken tests within the same short period of time, within a couple of days, and one's turned up positive and one's turned up negative.
100%. So, I mean, what's going on there? This was even reported in the New York Times, which kind of surprised me because they haven't said many true things about this whole story. But they reported that as much as 90% of the positives in the second wave were false positives. And that's correct. And I think, you know, we need to take that a little further. They're epidemiological false positives in the sense that they that they have no clinical significance. The people are not neither infectious nor going to get sick. And that's the vast majority of the cases. And the other thing that's helping this along, although I've come to understand that it's actually a smaller of the factors, is you're testing into a different population of people.
Yeah.
Lots of asymptomatic people, as opposed to the sick person who's arriving at hospital. That's where you used to be doing your testing. Okay. And then there's another phenomenon that with any test, you know, if the prevalence rate in the community is very low and the test has a probability of hitting a false positive, okay, even if that probability is quite low, when the prevalence out there is low, a high percentage of the tests that come back to you will be false positives. And that's true for any type of test. Okay. So we have this phenomenon of the case-demic. And you can see curves. In some countries, those case curves are bigger than the first curve. But then you look at the deaths. And what amazes me about this is how systematically the doctors on Team Panic and the scientists on Team Panic are prepared to lie about it. They all say, it's coming, 2 weeks. I heard nothing. The other day, it got extended out to 8 weeks. And I looked at the guys, come on, man. You know,
so, I mean,
in 8 weeks, everybody's going to die.
So we can question their motives maybe a bit later in the show. But I do want you to just present a few more of the interesting observations that you've picked up from the data. Because it's very easy for us to get conspiratorial about this quite quickly.
Yeah.
Again, because the decisions that have been made are just so counterintuitive to what all of science has taught us about immunology, about the way that humans have battled diseases and pandemics in the past, about how trying to create social distance between people leads to all kinds of second level effects like suicide and like isolation and like the inability of people to lead their lives normally, unemployment, economic devastation. All of these things are massively important too, but we'll get to those in a second. Who are the proponents of this Team Panic, and what's the data they, apart from the lies that you said that they're propagating, which I think it's evident for people to see. You just have to look at how these lies have been turned into political weapons in places like the United States. Are you talking to people in Sweden? What are they telling you?
Sorry, I just lost that last question.
Are you talking to people in Sweden, and what are they telling
you? Yes. Yeah, in Sweden, life goes on as normal. Yes, and we are talking to people in Sweden, and in fact, to people in many countries. Yeah, so in Sweden, life goes on as normal now. It's a little bit less activity, marginally less activity than there used to be, because they too are affected by what goes on in the rest of the world and so on.
Sure.
But, overall, they're almost back to normal. I think the rules have recently been relaxed for large scale gatherings and all of that. And they never shut down any businesses. They didn't shut down the kids' schools. Mm. They did very, very little, by way of mandates for the general population, general lockdowns, general closures. But I want to pick up on something, Gareth. You talk about conspiracy. One of the things I do not see in all of that conspiracy.
Yeah.
We've never harbored one theory about a conspiracy happening. The people who are doing this are telling you what they're doing, and they're doing it all in broad daylight.
Yeah.
Okay. So we do not have to worry about the Illuminati or 5G or poisons in the vaccines or any of this nonsense. What's happening is clear and out and in public. Okay. Now, who is the first world, the World Health Organization? These guys have been shocking from the start. They have inflamed the panic. And I will say this, there seems to be a school of thought among epidemiologists that the ethically correct thing to do is to scare the living crap out of people, because that'll cause them to take on behavioral changes that will protect them from the virus.
Well, in fact, this is the Joe Biden argument, because he says that Trump did a disservice by not telling people that they're likely to die.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. Whereas he said what he wanted to do was to avoid a panic until they could actually bed down proper procedures and so forth. But, of course, this then comes to the point. This is something that we've spoken about on the show in the past, this whole concept of the backfire effect, where people tend to double down at the point at which their initial predictions don't come true. And it's not dissimilar to people who are members of doomsday cults, you know, who will predict that, you know, for example, by 15th of September 1982, the world is going to come to an end. And that day arrives, and then they say, well, we've actually been granted a reprieve, and it's now going to be 15 years into the future or something like that. And it's a well-known thing from a psychological point of view. But I guess the more important question is, amidst all of this noise that we have from people essentially trying to bludgeon other people into silence, mm-hmm. how does one actually sift through all of this lot to actually get to information that's consistently credible that we can actually then refer to and say, look, this makes sense?
So I think, you know, a person who's not terribly afraid, who's not been, you know, had the fear of God struck into them, needs to apply their mind and listen and see the inconsistencies. If you were paying attention when the World Health Organization suddenly did a 180 degree turn and said everybody must wear cloth masks, okay? If you were paying attention, you would have noticed that they didn't support that with any science. If you were paying attention, you would have noticed that on the same day, their chief scientist stood up and said, asymptomatic transmission is very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that 4 hours later, after she'd said that, they were backpedaling on that announcement. Why? Because it contradicted the idea about the cloth masks,
right,
for which they presented no evidence.
Absolutely.
It's political. Now, you don't have to be a scientist to see that. Okay. And then that undermines the credibility of that entire organization, and it should. Okay. Lockdowns. If you were listening, the envoy went from the World Health Organization, went to New Zealand and told them, listen, don't go locking down now with this little outbreak you've got here. Lockdowns, you know, there's some issues with lockdowns. Not the best idea. Okay. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we had the envoy in South Africa. What did he say? Not a word. Okay, if you're not scared and you're thinking, you ask why.
Yeah, but
and should I be listening to them?
But then, you know, this inevitably leads us to the question of why people went along with this in their droves, why governments went along with this in their droves. I mean, the only singular exception with the possible exception of the states, certain states in the United States of America, is Sweden. Now, that's an enormous amount of peer pressure for a government to deal with. And the World Health Organization, you know, there isn't anything comparable to them in terms of scale and size and influence in world medicine. So you almost feel sorry for them because they were between a rock and a hard place. And to be the dissenting voice, the lone dissenting voice like Sweden were, they paid a very high price for that in the beginning when there were deaths.
Yes.
And people were saying, well, you see, this is a miscalculation by Sweden, and it's malice aforethought, and look at how they put their people in danger. And there was enormous criticism. There still is. In fact, there's still lots of people who are trying desperately to find a bad story to smear Sweden with, just because they didn't go with the common wisdom. And wisdom is in inverted commas here. So how do you make sense of this from a point of view that our descendants might, when they look back on the crazy decisions of 2020 and go, how could these people have been so stupid? What do we say to that?
Yeah. And just seeing you raise Sweden, I'm going to give you a fact which, you know, we've kind of worked out recently and that astounds people.
Yeah.
Sweden is going to end the year on zero excess mortality.
Really? In other words, it matches up with every
average
year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
All that noise, all that screeching, all the screaming about the deaths and the murder and all of this kind of thing. I mean, The Guardian was running a headline about Sweden every 2 days.
Yeah,
even as its epidemic was declining, they were doing that.
Absolutely.
You know, the noise was off the charts. They're going to end the year with average mortality. They would have done a very good job, because I can tell you what, we're not going to end the year with average mortality. We're going to be well above average this year. But let's go to the point. How did this happen? Where did this come from? Okay. And it's a very important question to ask, because all of the pre-COVID science, and when I say all, I mean all in the loudest possible voice I can use and the biggest capital letters I can write, all of the science said, do not quarantine, do not lock down. The World Health Organization's own science, the CDC's own science, many epidemiologists, many journals, said, do not lock down. The stuff gets politically manipulated. It harms people. The consequences of the lockdowns are greater than the benefits. This was the science.
Yeah.
So what happened? How does it happen that in January, February, March of this year, all of a sudden, we throw all of the science out the window and we go on this unprecedented erosion of civil liberties on a worldwide basis? How does it happen? Okay. The first thing that you have to understand is the role of social media, and behind that social media, the role of propaganda. Governments have actively sought to manipulate the psychology of their citizens. And the prime mover in this whole thing, the one who started it all off, was China.
Right.
There was a widespread social media campaign, including on platforms that are banned inside China. So this stuff does not come from inside China, okay? Mm-hmm. It comes from the CCP and its army of human bots, okay? It's got a huge number of people who seek to manipulate the information that is received by the citizens of China and by the outside world about China. This is well known. This is not some conspiracy theory, okay? They went on a massive propaganda campaign to market the Chinese solution of lockdown. And they're very good at locking down. I'm not contesting with that, okay? This is what lockdown is, what communists generally do. They lock everybody down in one shape, way, or form. Yeah, right now, there's a lockdown of the Uyghur minority in almost genocidal levels. I mean, it's quite sickening. This is what communists do. They lock down. And they marketed this thing. And then there was, in a small section of northern Italy, this outbreak
with
a hospital system. And other governments started picking this up and people started picking this up. When we started doing our research, we had to have a conversation about what we could possibly say without our heads being ripped off.
Yeah.
Because lockdown was popular. You couldn't find a person out there.
Yeah. People were very much behind the government, and they thought, well, this is for our own good. And you know, when you threaten people with death, which even I think I'm a fairly sensible person who doesn't respond to these fear tactics. I don't trust government on the best days. I found myself going, all right, well, I'll lock down for the initial 3-week period. I'll do what I have to do. I was frightened to see people who I thought might be vulnerable. And I thought I was quite a sensible person. I think many of us felt that way in the beginning.
Well, frankly, I'm still the sort of person who's afraid of inadvertently transmitting it to people who are in the high risk category, which is one of the reasons why I tend to be particularly cautious. It's not really out of concern for my own well-being. But I am terrified about infecting my parents, who are octogenarians, as an example. Mm. But, of course, that's entirely been driven by the assumption that, yes, there is the ability to transmit even when you're asymptomatic.
Yes, and I must say, there's some scientific doubt about that. So I reported what the World Health Organization person had said. We have disagreement inside our own group as to the size of the effect, okay? So it may be that asymptomatic people do transmit. The question is how much, okay? It's a very difficult thing to pin down because, you know, when somebody gets sick, it might be that they were exposed to multiple sources, and that person who's asymptomatic and some other person you don't know about who was symptomatic, or a contaminated surface, or an air conditioner system or something. There's so much you don't know about that transmission variable, okay? But it seems to be at least the case that asymptomatic people are much less likely to be transmitters. And we know for sure that children are low transmitters. And that one is the agonizing one for me. I mean, telling children that the bugs on their hands may kill granny.
It's just vicious. It's such nasty propaganda. Let's just talk about masks, because masks are something which has become controversial in America. You know, that half the country is absolutely convinced that masks are the most important thing. And when in this country, we see an almost religious devotion to these things. I've seen people on construction sites or doing heavy labor who are wearing masks the whole time, breathing in their own rotten breath over and over millions of times a day. And I just feel like this again is something which is approaching religious ritual in its yep. rigorous application for some people. It's surely one of those situations where, again, it depends on how you wear the mask. It depends on what kind of mask you have. And by no means does this thing prevent absolutely the spread of any kind of virus, let alone the coronavirus, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we're a country, we can't even learn to use condoms properly. And we got people walking around in masks who think that they're saving people's lives. Are you kidding?
Okay, so this is the first time that I'm going to allow myself to talk about masks on air. Okay, this whole time I've been resisting it. And the reason I've been resisting it is because of what Canton says. People are doing this because they don't want to hurt other people.
Right, so it comes from a good place. I get that.
From a good place, and because they're scared, mm-hmm. they're scared to kill people. They're scared for themselves sometimes. Yeah. You know, and you're right. I can't bear it. I mean, when I walk around, I have to correct myself. You know, because I actually physically get like the you know, it's just all wrong. Okay, it's not how society works. We need to live our lives. Mm-hmm. Okay, we can't go to pieces in the face of a seasonal respiratory virus. We're going to have them.
But all of that aside, because that's opinion, tell me what the facts and your analysis tell us about masks.
Okay. Good. Yes, thank you for bringing me back from the emotional place.
Not somewhere I like to dwell either.
No, I know, but it's so difficult.
Go on.
Okay, what do the facts say? As I said, there are no statistical signs in the data mm-hmm. of the effectiveness of any NPIs. Masks are NPIs. There's no sign in the data of mask mandate, very important, no sign in the data of mask mandate effectiveness. In the literature about mask effectiveness on an individual basis, so when so-and-so wears it compared to so-and-so, does this person get infected and this person get less frequently infected, that kind of scientific analysis, the data is very murky with respect even to surgical masks, okay? The World Health Organization itself did a meta study quite recently of 1,100, I think is the number, papers about masks and are they effective, okay? And the overwhelming majority of these papers finds no effect to a very small effect, and that small effect can go in both directions. There's some diseases, for example, in the case of, I think it's rhinovirus.
Yeah.
Wearing a mask makes it all worse, okay? So the effect size is small, whatever it is. And again, prior to coronavirus, the scientific recommendations were clear with respect to these general population actions. Mask mandates should not be undertaken. It was clear, okay? So mask mandates, I can tell you for sure, there's nothing showing in the data for the effectiveness of a mandate, okay? When it comes to, does the individual person get a bit of protection or protect other people? Yes, maybe, small effect size, okay? But also go back to this question that I posed at the beginning, the age differentiated strategy. If the right thing is for all of the not susceptible people, all the people who are not gonna die from this thing, if the right thing is for them to get infected as quickly as possible,
no.
then, and they want to save granny, mm-hmm. then you don't take measures, you know. You do the opposite. So it's not a straightforward thing. But for me, Gareth, that the consequential factors here that have been ignored when it comes to lockdowns and ignored when it comes to masks are the ones that are not being taken into account. The scientific advisors to government are not taking the holistic view that they should take. It is bad for our society to be shoving masks onto the face of 10-year-old kids when they're running around the playground. It's bad for the children psychologically.
Absolutely.
We should stop this nonsense.
I think I actually think, and I know that most parents would be horrified to hear me say this, but they obviously, again, it comes from a good place where they're trying to protect their children and trying to protect other people that their children might infect. But I do think it's a kind of child abuse to prevent them from having normal social interactions with other children and to have ruined effectively, specifically for people who are school going and haven't been able to go to school for at least the last 5 or 6 months. You have ruined their ability to connect properly with other human beings. You've put the fear of God into them. I think it's a kind of child abuse, and it's been mandated by government, which makes it worse.
It's terrible. Yeah.
Yeah, look, my particular thought on that is that if we were going through this for a finite period and we had a definite sense of what are the parameters we need to be looking out for at which we can actually turn around and say, right, we've now hit a point where we can start scaling back on these measures. The difficulty that I have right now, and perhaps you could throw some light on this, is that there are no measurable points that we can actually look at. So, for example, when we have El Presidente turning around and saying that we are moving from level 2.5 to level 1.76, as an example, appears to be no discernible difference in terms of the data between the two levels.
Yeah.
So there's no measurable that we're actually looking at that says, here's why we are doing what we are doing right now. Translated to other things like the purported lifting of some travel restrictions, which have kicked in over the past couple of days. Now, we suddenly see that, well, we are lifting restrictions for the following countries, but we are not lifting restrictions for these other countries. And again, appears to be no rational basis around why those decisions are being taken. So where do we look for those markers? What should be the data points that we should be looking out for? Because look, frankly, from my side, it's an inconvenience for me to wear a mask, but it's not something that I feel religiously about, because by and large, I'm sitting where I am right now in my office and working from here. When I'm walking around my house, I'm not wearing a mask. And obviously my family doesn't wear masks at home, because that would be just, you know, completely stupid. But so the point at which I do end up wearing,
I mean, you
a mask
say that, is, you say that almost as if it's a given, but I see people driving in their car on their own with the mask on.
Yes, because, and the reason why a lot of people are doing that is because police officers have actually been told that people who are driving their cars are required to do that. And, you know, I got stopped by a Metro police officer who chided me for not wearing my mask in the car. And the reason why I very quickly put the mask on is because I was actually running late to make a delivery to some friends of mine who were desperately hungry. And I didn't want to argue with the police officer. Otherwise, I would have said something like, well, when you're sleeping alone, do you wear a condom? Because it makes about as much sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, when you're dealing with a statement like I've just made, you know, when you've looked at the data for months and months and months and you can see no benefit from lockdown, no benefit from mask wearing, no benefit from social distancing, et cetera, in the data. And somebody asked me, you know, what are the markers on which we should use to change the levels? I shrug. You know, if there's no scientific basis for the measure in the first place, then how am I meant to decide when we lift it? You know, so you know, the right time to lift all of these measures, unfortunately, was when they were imposed.
So Nick, I mean, now,
and you're right. There's no science behind it. There can't be. There is no science. Yeah.
I think that, you know, we've only got 5 minutes left of this, 2-3 minutes, in fact. I would love to talk to you all day, because I think we've left a lot of this stuff on the cutting room floor. But the reality is, all of this information that we're now gathering and all of this that we're starting to make sense of now, that proves that lockdowns were probably a stupid idea, if not a damn right, undeniably dangerous idea. That this disease is not nearly the threat that people thought that it was, that we should open schools immediately, that we should probably, if we're nervous people, wear masks and, you know, keep old people in safe places and maybe isolate them a little longer and a little more. But otherwise, we should get on with our lives. All of that, let's imagine a wonderful world where people would take the information which you've so diligently collated here and presented to us this morning. That's not going to happen, of course. And the people who made these disastrous decisions have blood on their hands. I don't mean that in some dramatic way. I think that in reality, their decisions have led to widespread devastation, and they will they'll probably never be held accountable. Is there a purpose to looking at this stuff with hindsight? There must be people listening now going, well, I'm exasperated. This is how I felt the whole way through lockdown. Your evidence that you've brought this morning proves that I was right. And now there's nothing I can do about it. So it's like you know, it's like reading the sports results 3 days later and you go, oh, well, that, you know, that would have helped when we were watching the game, but now it's pointless. What do you make of that?
Well, if science and reason and the way of life that we've become accustomed to survive this one, because there's still in my mind a question mark as to whether they do. Okay, we're not over this. You look at what's going on in other countries. I mean, it's absolutely malarkic. The UK is going into, you know, crazy rules when their epidemic isn't even there. Their deaths are running at 1/10 the level of influenza deaths, you know, currently. And they're considering all these crazy measures that like severely constrain society. So we are not out of the woods. The madness is continuing and in some places escalating. People are talking about 2-year lockdowns and things like this. Okay. So we are not out of the woods. But let's take your thought experiment. Okay. We have to make sure this never happens again. Never again. So it has to be understood. The etiology. Sorry, big word. The process of the disease, the progress of the disease of our society needs to be understood so we can stop it ever from happening again. We need to amend constitutions. We need to pay attention to our laws about how social media are utilized. Okay, we need to educate people and inform them. And we need to do this on a massive scale. Otherwise, I fear that we are dealing with a problem that will live with us.
I'm going to play devil's advocate at this point, but isn't that exactly what the Chinese have been doing from the other side?
Yes, they've been doing it from the other side.
Yes, they've been controlling social media. They've been managing the debate.
No question.
Yeah. Yes. So how does that differentiate us from them?
Well, I'm a moral realist. I believe in good things and bad things, okay? I believe that liberty is a good thing. I believe that personal agency is a good thing. I would like to see less inequality in the world, okay? But I believe that what the Chinese do when they run their society is bad because all of those things do not exist there, okay? So, yes, they've had economic growth to the extent that they've liberalized their economy. I'm not on their side. And that's not a statement against the Chinese people. That's a statement against the CCP and that way of life that they seek to impose wherever they go, as they have recently done in Hong Kong, okay? I have none of that. Nick Hudson doesn't vote for this way. Nick Hudson votes for liberty, for personal agency. So we must be on the right side. There is an asymmetry here in this battleground. There's an asymmetric warfare. We have to turn around and respond. Mm. We can't continue just to be misled by the propaganda. We have to fight it.
Well, I
just one final question that I want to get in here.
Grant?
That's to answer a debate that in terms of whether a person who has been previously infected has the ability to become reinfected. Ah. Now, I've been trawling through a lot of the literature to try and find one credible documented case where this has in fact happened. And I've been having great difficulty coming across it. I have come across many websites that claim to do this, but they are self-referential websites. They quote themselves and generally point to an anonymous person in Hong Kong that has become the first person to be reinfected.
Okay, Canton, I'm so glad you asked this because this is a classic example of words being important, of the semantics, the meanings of words being important. Remember earlier on, I distinguished between being infected and having the disease? Okay. Reinfection happens with many diseases all the time. In fact, it's almost the standard process. When I say reinfection, it means the virus enters your cells somewhere in your body. Okay. The question is not whether you reinfect it, but whether you go on to produce the disease a second time. Okay. And the answer to that is no. That's not how the body's immune system works. Again, yes, there will be some exceptions. So if you were infected when you're 20 years old and now you're 104 and on your deathbed and that virus gets into your system, you're dealing then with a problem called immunosenescence, aging of the immune system, and you might get sick again and die from the disease. Okay. But for ordinary people, the evidence is clear that infection produces a substantial protective response and the declining antibodies that you read about, irrelevant. The immune system has memory, B-cell memory and T-cell memory that provide you with future protection. And the fact that people are being shouted at and screamed at for making this basic point is shameful. Okay? The fact that people are using that little word, reinfected, to imply that you can get sick again is shameful. It's not how viruses and diseases work, and it's not how this one works.
Sure.
Simple.
All right. That helps. That helps. So everybody stop panicking. Don't join Team Panic, as Nick calls it. This is very valuable information. Nick, you guys have a website we can obviously go and look at, and you're publishing more and more information as you go. Just give us a way to find out more if we feel that this is just too little and we need to continue our investigations and yes. our research and also use this information to spread sensibility rather than panic through society, especially to those people who are hunkered down, who haven't left their house in 6 months, who are shit scared that something's going to come and kill them. How can we help those people?
Okay. I will put a link on our website mm-hmm. to the exceptionally good interview of Jay Bhattacharya, Michael Levitt, and Martin Kulldorff yep. from last week.
Great.
It's 2 hours long.
Yep.
If people don't have 2 hours, I will also post my summary of that discussion. That's a shorter read. That's a 5 minute, 10 minute read. Okay?
Okay.
I would recommend that people start there. It's a very good, and that's top notch scientists. You don't have to worry about this crazy actuary and capped up. Okay. Go and listen to those people. The website is a good place to start. We've got a lot of information there. And we've been very careful to stick to the science. There's no funnies on there. Okay. If you start with those resources, you're doing fine. And if you're on social media, I would recommend following people like Martin Kulldorff and Michael Levitt, because they are voices of reason and sanity. They are not people who are corrupted by, big pharma money or, any kind of role that they have in an institution. They're independent people who will be fine whatever happens. Okay.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you very much for talking to us. CliffCentral.com